to hold his wits, sometimes come together, kaleidoscope-wise, in the image of a feathered, tender thing that might, once upon a time, have sat upon his egg. Although his coxcomb is long gone, he still cries, "Cock-a-doodle-doo!" The empty centre of an empty horizon, Walter flutters across the snowy wastes. He is a sentient being still, but no longer a rational one. Indeed, now he is all sensibility, without a grain of sense, and sense impressions alone have the power to shock and to ravish him. In his elevated state, he hearkens to the rhythm of the drum. Strange phenomenon of the landscape, as if it might have been sounds from the earth under the snow or the heavens above it. A hollow, insistent drumming, soft at first, then increasing in intensity. A pitter-pat, a rat-a-tap, and then a bim-bam-bom. Ruddy-be-dubbity-dub, and a rat-a-tat-tat. Tattoos and rifts of the more than Afro-Caribbean complexity. Not that he can identify the drumming as drumming. It might it not, be nothing but the product of his disordered brains. He pauses on one leg, like a stork, sniffing the air as if to smell out from which direction, if any, this invocation comes. But the cold snaps at his testicles when he stands still, and with a brief scream he leaps off again, coming to rest before the antlers of a reindeer bull, sticking up out of the snow, and looking for all the world like an abandoned hat rack. When Walter sniffed the air this time, his nostrils dilated at a whiff of something savoury, something aromatic on the cold, scoured air. The drumming grew louder and louder, more and more rhythmically innovative, as he pursued the delicious scent. Until, among the trees, he found a brazier containing a small fire, from which fragrant smoke issued. Beside the fire stood a being composed, or so it would seem, of fringed leather, gaudy rags, and tinkling metal ornaments, applying the wooden stick he held in one hand to a skin drum the size of a dustbin lid, of the kind Irish musicians called a bodhrum, brightly painted with all manner of strange devices, stretched on a wooden frame. This drum was talking to the wilderness in its own language. The shaman was not in the least surprised to see Walter, for he had drummed himself into the state of transcendental ecstasy demanded by his profession, and his spirit was now disporting itself with a company of horned ancestors, of birds with fins and fish on stilts, and many other physiologically anomalous apparitions, amongst which Walter cut rather an everyday figure. Walter squatted by the fire, enjoying the smoke and reacquainting himself with the sensuality of warmth, until the shaman's eyes popped, his lips frothed, and he fell down, dropping the drum, which rolled a little way on the snow, and then toppled over. Walter reached out for it, but found he could coax only a few little muffled rumbles out of it. He did not know how to make the drum speak, and if he found out by accident, he could not have understood it. Time passed. The shaman sighed, got up, shook the snow off the skirts of his leather dress, and saw that Walter was still there. The shaman was prepared for anything when he took a spirit journey, and greeted Walter affectionately, assuming he was an emanation of the wild, which had elected to stick around a while after the drumming that summoned him stopped, and would, in its own good time, softly and silently, vanish away. But when Walter, recalling how nice things happened after he had done so once before, began to rub his belly with a circular motion, the shaman had second thoughts. He addressed Walter in his native tongue, an obscure Finno-Ugrian dialect just about to perplex three generations of philologists. "Whence cometh thou? Whither goeth thou?" Walter giggled, went nowhere, went on rubbing his belly. From the satchel in which he transported his fetishes, the shaman unpacked the tumbler in which he'd proposed to serve himself tea, prepared on the brazier with the aid of a tea-brick, to restore himself after his exertions. He modestly turned his back, raised his skirt, and pissed into this tumbler. Then, with smiling formality, he offered the steaming glass of amber fluid to his unexpected guest. "No sugar," complained Walter. "No lemons." But he was thirsty, and he drank. Then his eyes began to spin round and round in his head, and to send off sparks like Catherine wheels. Even the shaman, well used to the effects of fly agaric distilled through the kidneys, was startled. Walter entered an immediate fugue of hallucinations, in which birds, witches, mothers and elephants, mixed up with sights and smells of Fisherman's Wharf, the Alhambra Theatre London, the Imperial Circus Petersburg, and many other places. All his past life coursed through his head in concrete but discrete fragments, and he could not make head nor tail of any of it. He began to babble helplessly, in a language unknown to the shaman, which excited the shaman's curiosity all the more. The shaman packed up his belongings and slung his drum over his shoulder. He emptied the fire out of the brazier and stamped on it to put it out. He packed up the brazier. Himself, he was pretty sure by now that Walser, whatever he was not one of his own hallucinations, and might, he conjectured, be an apprentice shaman from another tribe, of, he noted, a markedly different physical type, who had wandered off course during the ill-planned trip. He picked Walter up in a fireman's lift, he was a small man but tough, and started off back to his own village with him. Upside down, Walter continued to upbraid the embroidered back of the shaman's ceremonial frock. The hallucinogenic urine put the sluggish motor in his skull into overdrive. "Oh," he declaimed to the oncoming Siberian dawn, "what a piece of work is man!" Chapter 7. The escapee opened up, came inside, had a good toast at the fire, and was tickled pink to discover such a motley crew held hostage in the outlaws' camp. He was a well-educated man, boy I should say, for he wasn't above 20 and didn't look his age. A fresh-faced, bright-eyed, eager little cherub who spoke very fair French and enough English to get by. And he was a breath of fresh air in this miserable place, I can tell you, for he never mentioned yesterday. All he could talk of was tomorrow, a shining morrow of peace and love and justice, in which the human soul, ever through history striving for harmony and perfection, would at last achieve it. And to the coming century, he looked for the delivery of the concentrated essence of all the good things of that ideal tomorrow. He'd been sent off to exile for trying to bring utopia one step nearer by blowing up a copper shop, which made our Liz look kindly upon him at first. But when he embarrassedly confessed there'd been no bang nor damage because the dynamite was damp, Liz tut-tutted his inefficiency. Her brow darkened with displeasure at him, and with his soul, with his tomorrow, she ferociously took issue. "First place, what is this soul of which you speak? Show me its location in the human anatomy, and then I might believe in it. But I tell you straight, dissect away as much as you like, you won't find it. And you can't make perfect a thing that don't exist, so scrub the soul from out of your discourse. Second place, as we say in our country, tomorrow never comes, which is why you'll promise jam tomorrow. We live, as always, in the here and now, the present. To pin your hopes upon the future is to consign those hopes to a hypothesis, which is to say, a nothingness. Here and now is what we must contend with. Third place, how will you recognise perfection when you see it? You can only define the future perfect by the present imperfect, and a present in which inevitably we all live always seems imperfect to somebody. This present time seems quite sufficiently perfect to such as the Grand Duke that wanted my foster daughter here to add to his collection of toys. For the wretched peasants whose rents pay for his extravagances, the present is merry hell. If we abandon the grammatical metaphor, I'd certainly agree with you that this present which we contemporaneously inhabit is imperfect to a degree. But this grievous condition has nothing to do with the soul, or as you might also call it, removing the theological connotation, human nature. It isn't in that Grand Duke's nature to be a bastard, hard though it may be to believe, nor does it lie in those of his employees to be slaves. What we have to contend with here, my boy, is the long shadow of the past historic, reverting back to the grammatical analogy for a moment, that forge the institutions which create the human nature of the present in the first place. It's not the human soul that must be forged on the anvil of history, but the anvil itself must be changed in order to change humanity. And we might see, if not perfection, then something a little better, or not to raise too many false hopes, a little less bad. So I could tell she was feeling more chipper, and the escapee was getting more than he bargained for when he took shelter in the outlaw camp. But before he and Liz came to blows on how humanity might be most efficaciously rendered more virtuous, I steps in quick, asking what's going on outside. Seems the outlaws are so sunk in gloom to find I'm not the Princess of Wales, or ever shall be, they're drowning their sorrows. But it doesn't cheer them up. The more they drink, the more they weep, as if what goes in must come out. And if we don't console them somehow, the escapee thinks it's very likely they'll have a little shooting party, and so good night, God bless, finito. But he has more news. For it seems he fell in with a band of women, trekking towards the interior, all of whom had broken out of an institution for the criminally insane nearby, leaving the governess locked up inside behind them as, for what he said they said, she thoroughly deserved to be. These women planned to found a female utopia in the Tiger, and asked a favour of the escapee, that he should deliver them up a pint or two of sperm, which, speedily freezing at the inhospitable temperature of the region, could be stored away in a patent ice bucket, like an enormous thermos flask they carried with them, so they could use it when they got settled to impregnate such of them as were of childbearing age, and so ensure the survival of this little republic of free women. With this request he had complied. I could see he was a perfect gentleman.
What'll they do with the boy babies? Feed them to the polar bears? To the female polar bears?
Demanded Liz, who was in a truculent mood and clearly thought herself back in Whitechapel at a meeting of the Godwin and Wollstonecraft Debating Society. I hushed her up. Mention of the patent ice bucket piqued my curiosity.
I asked them where they got it from, said the escapee, and they told me, from the dining room of a wrecked train on the Great Siberian Railway.
The colonel broke down when he heard about the elephants. How these women saw the lifeless bodies lying around the track, like so many overturned pantechnicons, and only forestalled tears by blowing his nose forcefully again and again on a succession of the small silk American flags, of which he kept a seemingly inexhaustible supply upon his person. But I pressed the escapee for news of human survivors. And bless me, it turned out the women found a blonde foreigner tucked up among some tablecloths with not a scratch on him, but left him behind when they saw a rescue party on the way. And by the time the escapee met them, were already regretting having abandoned such a fine repository of seamen. I was overcome with emotion when I heard all this. I forgot myself so far as to cry out, "My young man will come and save us!" "An old arduous sentimental booby. Sounds like he's in no fit state to save himself," said Lizzie. "I like the sound of the rescue party better." But it turns out the escapee is primarily on the run from the rescue party, which would rescue him right back to the penal colony. And the outlaws, too, would best shift themselves sharpish, or they'll have a lot to answer for when the fire ambulance and police arrive. The colonel is as pleased as Punch, however. I can see he's already plotting the tall headlines in all the newspapers. Just wait until he gets to a telegraph. He reckons this catastrophe will end up making a mint for him, one way or another. His optimism is of the remorseless kind that can't see the cloud for the silver lining. Any sudden burst of renewed high spirits, he lets out a series of American Indian war whoops and commences to jig. His exuberance brings me down to earth for whatever happens next. We're at this moment stuck in the outback in the snowdrift amongst a crowd of trigger-happy brigands far gone in liquor and armed to the teeth, whom we needs must persuade for their own good to leave us behind and run away.
"Now, lads," says Lizzie to the clowns, "the time has come to shake off your lethargy. You must put on such a show for our hosts as will wake them up so they'll listen to reason. Make them smile, make them laugh, then we can talk to them. Bring them back to life, my lads."
Perhaps hers was an unfortunate choice of words, recalling as it did their old routine of the clown's funeral, which they would never undertake again. I will leery of the idea at first,
because with both folk gone, and all their gear, only got left the rags they stood up in, and the fiddle, the tambourine, the triangle, no more, they couldn't see their way to doing their best, although their card tricks went down so well with a fire boy.
"Think of it," pleads Lizzie, "as a requiem for Bufo."
At that, they all exchange a look, a strange, dark, sad look that, had it been sound, would have reverberated around and round amongst them like the notes of a solemn organ in a great cathedral. When the last echoes of that look, that unspoken message, that mute avowal of some intent unknown to us, died away, old Grock picks up his triangle, gives it a kick, and Grick removes a little fiddle from his hat. I won't say they give me much joy when they start up the dead march from Saul. I get that goose walking over my grave feeling that tells me something is up. But it's a start. One red-headed fellow, after a bit, picks up a log of wood and hits a dwarf with it. The fire boy is convulsed with mirth. I unbar the door, and out they troop. The outlaws had summoned up enough spirit to light a fire in the middle of the camp, and we're all sitting round on tree stumps in the attitude of Rodin's thinker. A light snow falling, snow settled on their heads. The clans had lost their leader, so it took a little while for them to work out what to do. One performed a cartwheel in a desultory manner, until another tripped him over, and then, for these were simple folk, the outlaw chief's cheeks crumpled under the flicker of a smile. That seemed to give the clan's heart, or some more complex motivation, for they all snapped to, and Grick and Grock striking a more rhythmic note, they all began to dance. But what was the tune they played? Damned if I can put a name to it. Eldritch music from a witch's Sabbath. And as for their dancing, was dance the right word for it? Nothing about that dance to cheer the heart. God, I thought, we're fools. Did you ever yourself, Feathers, laugh at a clown? Not even if it were ever so? Didn't the clowns always summon to your mind disintegration, disaster, chaos? This dance was a dance of death. And they danced it for George Buffins, that they might be as him. They danced it for the wretched of the earth, that they might witness their own wretchedness. They danced a dance of the outcasts for the outcasts who watched them amid the lowering trees with a blizzard coming on. And one by one, the outcast outlaws raised their heads to watch, and all indeed broke out in laughter. But it was a laughter without joy. It was the bitter laugh one gives when one sees there is no triumph over fate. And we saw those cheerless arabesques as of the damned and heard that laughter of those trapped in the circles of hell. Liz and I held hands for comfort. They danced the night into the clearing, and the outlaws welcomed it with cheers. They danced the perturbed spirit of their master who came with a great wind and blew cold as death into the marrow of the bones. They danced a whirling apart of everything, the end of love, the end of hope. They dance tomorrows into yesterdays. They dance the exhaustion of the implacable present. They dance a deadly dance of the past perfect which fixes everything fast so it can't move again. They dance the dance of old Adam who destroys the world because we believe he lives forever. The outlaws entered into the spirit of the thing with a will. With huzzas and bravos, all sprang up and flung themselves into the wild gavotte, firing off their guns. The snow hurled wet white sheets in our faces, and the wind took up the ghastly music of the old clowns and amplified it fit to drive you crazy. Then the snow blinded us, and Samson picked us up one by one and flung us back in that shed and leaned up hard against the door, forcing it close against the tempest with his mighty shoulders. Though bullets crashed into the walls, and the wind came whistling through the knotholes and picked up burning embers from the fire, hurling them about until we thought we might burn to death in the middle of the snow and ice, the shed held firm. It rocked this way and that way from me. It seemed at any moment the roof might be snatched away, but this little group of us who, however incoherently, placed our faith in reason, were not exposed to the worst of the storm. The SKP, however, faced with this insurrection of militant pessimism, turned pale and wan, and murmured to himself comforting phrases of Kropotkin, etc., as others might in such straits recite the rosary. When the storm passed, as pass it did, at last, the freshly fallen snow made all as new, and put the campfire out.
Here there was a shred of scarlet satin, and there, Crick's little violin with the strings broken. But of the tents, shacks, muskets and cuirasses of the outlaws, the clans and the clans themselves, not one sight, as if all together had been blown off the face of the earth. But one poor dog is left behind. The whirlwind must have dropped him off, poor thing. A little mongrel pup with a pom-pom on his tail, running round in circles whining. And I hope that outlaw chief was blown clear back to his own village, to find the plough waiting for his hand, the swollen udders of the cow anticipating his fingers, the brown hen clucking for him to collect neglected eggs, and all as it had been, the dear home of nostalgia, enriched by absence. But where the clans had got to, I do not know. Gone to join George Buffins in the great madhouse in the sky, no doubt. Lizzie offers no apology for having unwittingly precipitated this denouement. She shrugs, observes, good riddance to bad rubbish, strips off, and puts on a set of the bearskins which she's stitched into coats and trousers for us all. With her moustache and brown face and the shako she's made herself to keep her ears warm, she looks like a little bear herself. Shanks's pony, she says. Let's be off. Although the battered shed still stands, none of us survivors have any inclination to stay in that ill-omened place. We shall set boldly forth and rescue ourselves. We don the products of Lizzie's improvised tailoring to keep us warm en route, and strike off in what the escapee thinks is the direction of the railway track. After some thought, he consents to come with us as guide. The colonel had made extravagant promises about American passports, and this young man is the face of one who will believe the beautiful promise of the Statue of Liberty. The others are amazed at what has come to pass, but all that Liz and I know is the clans made an invocation to chaos, and chaos, always imminent in human affairs, came in on cue. But the escapee remains most troubled in his mind over the occurrence, and tries to engage me in debate on its significance. Look, love, I says to him eventually, because I'm not in the mood for literary criticism. If I hadn't bust a wing in the train wreck, I could fly us all to Vladivostok in two shakes. So I'm not the right one to ask questions of when it comes to what is real and what is not, because like the duckbill platypus, half the people who clap eyes on me don't believe what they see, and the other half think they're seeing things. That shut him up. I'm glad to see the colonel takes the loss of the clans in his stride, no doubt rehearsing in his mind the interviews he'll give the press.
Clowns blow away in blizzard, a witness account of famous circus proprietor.
Some of us are less resilient. Mignon clings tight to the princess's hand, but the princess's eyes are vacant. If we don't get that girl to a keyboard soon, it will go the worse for her, I says to Liz. Samson wraps her in furs and carries her, Mignon trotting behind. And so we leave the outlaw camp, or what remains of it, and the little clan dog comes with us, not wanting to be left behind by himself. And what makes me sad, I find upon the wind-blown snow, a little way on, just the one feather, the purple feather the fireboy stole from me, that must have fallen from his jacket as the wind swept him off. And so our journeyings commenced again, as if they were second nature. Young as I am, it's been a picaresque life. Will there be no end to it? Is it my fate to be a female Quixote, with Liz, my Sancho Panza? If so, what of the young American? Will he turn out to be the beautiful illusion, the Dulcinea of that sentimentality for which Liz upbraids me, telling me it's but the obverse to my enthusiasm for hard cash? Trudge on, girl, and let events dictate themselves. But although we trudged long and far, we stayed in the forest. Seemed to get no nearer to the railway track than when we'd started out, and the escapee adopts a worried look. Has he taken a wrong turning out here where there are no turnings? Or rather in this trackless waste at any single point one stands at an imaginary crossroads, at the confluence of all directions, none of which might be the right direction. And on we go, for fear of freezing to the spot if we stand still. Then the trees thin out and stop, and the escapee is mightily discomforted, for we've come to the bank of a wide frozen river, which he hadn't taken into account at all. But on the other side of the river, there is a little house of the most unsuitable frilled and gophered kind the Russians elect to build out here, and the escapee guesses, by its loneliness, it is the home of an exile such as he was, who will give us a welcome. So we slip and slide across the river with little spectral eddies and scurries of wind-blown snow starting up around us like agents of foul weather, and walk up to the front door nice as you please, as if making a formal call in Belgravia, London. Nailed to the wall beside the door is a shingle on which, in the Cyrillic script, is the inscription, Conservatoire of Transbaikalia, and then a name with a string of letters after. But this shingle is so stained with moss and age, the name is indecipherable. The shingle looks as though it has been uselessly advertising for pupils for decades. The escapee knocked at the door. No reply. No light shone inside, no smoke came out the chimney. He knocked once more, and then we pushed the door open, to find the stink of humanity inside, certainly, but in the first room we came to, no other sign of it. The building itself was built of pine, the only flooring being a deep layer of fish bones that shone like ivory, and told us that the tenant of this dolorous place ate mostly fish from the river. In the next room a stove, with the cold remains of fire in it, and an unlit lamp. The colonel dipped his finger in the lamp, discovered it was filled with fish oil, and at once applied for a dose in order to give a polish to Sybil, whose skin was losing its gloss and suppleness without her daily going over, so she was looking more and more like a wallet. Liz let him dab a bit on one of his little flags. He squatted down at once, rubbing away as if she were not a pig, but Aladdin's lamp. What an aroma!
Pwah!
I should say the place was furnished, roughly, even exiguously, with a few chairs and a table, whose red plush covers, mildewed though they were, hinted touchingly at former pretensions. On the wall, a daguerreotype of a young man standing between a potted palm and a grand piano, and what's more, a print, as it might have been antique, of a boy in a peruke that Liz swore was Mozart. So whoever lived here, or what had lived here, but by the smell might recently have dropped off his perch, had been of a musical bent. I immediately drew the princess's attention to these relics, but they were not sufficient by themselves to cheer her up. We lit the lamp and fixed up a fire in the stove with some wood Samson found in an outhouse to fumigate the old mortality from the place before we opened the door to the third room. To find, of all things, as if in answer to a prayer, not the photograph of a grand piano, but the very thing itself, with the lid open, like a big black butterfly just come to rest, and upon it a metronome. The princess said nothing, but the glaze lifted from her eyes, and she flexed her fingers and clapped her hands like a delighted child. Coming back to herself in an instant, she sprang forward to the instrument, but just then, a tall, gaunt something, hitherto hidden from us by the ebony wings, starts up from an unseen stool at the keyboard and gives out with a wail. The shadows cast by the lamp Liz held turned him into something frightful, ghoulish even. Hair down to his bum, and mixed in with a beard that reached his navel, and his fingernails were as long as those of Trouvelpeter in the picture book. You could see he hadn't the art to touch his piano in a month of Sundays, for all he threw himself protectively across the keys, letting fall such a clatter of discordant notes you could tell it hadn't been tuned in years either. No doubt, when he first caught sight of us, he thought a pack of bears had come visiting. He whinnied with terror, jerking his grasshopper limbs in all directions, producing a cornucopia of atonal effects, and then he scrambled up on top of the thing, waving his arms as if either he'd protect it with his life or else dive into its innards to hide. He seemed undecided as to which course to follow. He dislodged the metronome, which fell to the floor on its side on the carpet of fishbones, and commenced to tick like a clock.
"Mad as a hatter," said our Liz, "fit to be tied."
The princess made faint mewing sounds, stretching her hands towards the piano beseechingly in a manner fit to melt a heart of stone, but the mad old man no longer knew he had a heart. Mignon it was, restraining Lizzie with a brusque gesture, kicked the ticking metronome to death, cleared her throat, expectorated neatly, and began to sing. When we first heard her sing, in my room in the Hotel de l'Europe, it sounded as if the song sang itself, as if the song had nothing to do with Mignon, and she was only a kind of fleshy phonograph made to transmit music of which she had no consciousness. That was before she became a woman. Now she seized hold of the song in the supple lasso of her voice and mated it with her newfound soul, so the song was utterly transformed, and yet its essence did not change. In the same way a familiar face changes yet stays the same when it is freshly visited by love. If she sang a cappella, and so only gave us half the song, still it was almost too much for me, because she chose the last song of the winter journey, where the mad young man drifts off into the snow, following the organ grinder. And will the winter journey of the young man wandering so far away from me turn out so badly? And what of my own journey? What of that? Bereft of my sword as I am, crippled as I am, yesterday's sensation, a worn-out wonder. Pull yourself together, girl. The hairy old man went on scratching himself during the first verse, but slowed down somewhat during the second, and during the third, he stretched out first one leg, then the other. You could hear the bones creak, and flop back down on the piano stool. I never heard an instrument so out of tune and harsh as he picked out the little phrase in the accompaniment that mimics the hurdy-gurdy. Very slowly, with a perceptible clicking of the finger joints, he picked out that phrase again, then again, and the discords made no difference because it was supposed to sound out of tune, like a hurdy-gurdy.
Gosh, a baritone should sing it, really.
I'd never heard the princess say so much as good morning before, so it came as a shock, the real rough French of Marseille, and as one might have expected, a low voice, like a growl.
Fucking shit,
she said.
That piano needs a screwdriver.
Happily, the old man, after some thought, discovered a bit of rusty French and tried it out, and we left the three of them quarrelling happily about how best to strip the piano down and so on. You could not make out any change in the old man's facial expression due to his abundance of facial hair, but he seemed to be taking everything in his stride. All there was in his larder was a tiny portion of smoked, at a guess, elk, and a semi-refrigerated rat, the latter, I should have thought, the accidental victim of a private misfortune rather than a regular item of diet. When we found the larder so bare, there fell out an ugly disagreement between the colonel and the SKP over Sybil, who looked like a good dinner to the one, but for the other lay under the protection of the taboo against the slaughter of beasts whom we love. In spite of that taboo, Sybil might have escaped the gluttony of the fireboy, only to succumb to the democratic appetite of her friends, because at last the SKP said, "Let's vote on it." Fond as I was of the little pig, not a bite had passed my lips since my interrupted breakfast, and greater love hath no pig that it should lay down its life. Sybil knew something was in the wind, although her clairvoyant talents did not stretch far enough to tell her what it was. She burrowed for cover down into the colonel's waistcoat, where she quivered like a disturbed paunch.
"Eat me before you eat her!"
cried the colonel.
"Make a supper of long pig before you tuck into my pig, you cannibal!"
But the escapee ignored emotional blackmail. "All those in favour of roast pork, raise your hands." Just as he, Liz, me and Samson formed a reluctant majority, the clown dog, who'd tagged along with us thus far, now foolishly drew attention to himself by whining at the door to be let out, perhaps thinking to make a getaway. But we forestalled that. We ate him instead of Sybil, boiling him in melted snow because he was too tough to roast, so there was a bit of broth as well. Fido or Bonzo or whatever he was called didn't go far amongst seven, but he staved off the pangs. So this last relic of the gigantic uselessness of the clowns served some function in the end. And next morning, or nearly noon, I should say, for day breaks in a sluggish fashion in the winter of these latitudes, the mad old man dragged himself away from the music room long enough to take those non-musicians amongst us to the river and show us how he did his fishing. So as regards grub, things were looking up. The old man's clothes, if perfectly acceptable on the concert hall rostrum, were a mite out of place in the middle of nowhere, especially since, for outdoor wear, he donned a stovepipe hat, somewhat concertinaed in the crown. But he knew what he was doing. He left behind the rod and lines and took a big knife with him. And what he did was this. He knelt on the solid ice, cut out a block and held it up to see if there was a fish in it. Third time lucky, he'd cut in half a frozen carp. Then we all set to and carried home enough for breakfast, though the ice weighed very heavy. Long before we reached the front door, we heard them. Sound travels far on that vacant air, and it is possible the wooden halls of the little house, acting as a sounding box, improved the tone of the piano whilst magnifying its sound. Anyway, clear as a bell. She'd fixed it so it was as good as new, the marvellous girl. And if I might prophesy squabbles in the future as to who should solo, the old man was too moved to hear them at that moment to complain. Mignon's song is not a sad song, not poignant, not a plea. There is a grandeur about her questioning. She does not ask you if you know that land of which she sings because she herself is uncertain it exists. She knows, oh, how well she knows it lies somewhere, elsewhere, beyond the absence of the flowers. She states the existence of that land, and all she wants to know is whether you know it too. Just as, drawn by the magnet of the song, and insensible to all else, we reached the garden gate, humping the lumps of ice whose dripping weight we had forgotten in our pleasure, Sybil, tucked into the colonel's waistcoat, whimpered, and her nose began to twitch. We saw the house was roofed with tigers. Authentic, fearfully symmetric tigers, burning as brightly as those who had been lost. These were the native tigers of the place, who had never known either confinement or coercion. They had not come to the princess for any taming, as far as I could see, although they stretched out across the tiles like abandoned greatcoats, laid low by pleasure. And you could see how the tails that dropped down over the eaves like icicles of fur were throbbing with marvellous sympathy. Their eyes, gold as the background to a holy picture, had summoned up the sun that glazed their pelts until they looked unutterably precious. Under that unseasonable sun, or under the influence of the voice and the piano, all the wilderness was stirring, as if with new life. Came a faint shimmer of birdsong, and a whirring as of wings, soft growls and mews and squeaks of paw on snow, and a distant crack or two, as if the ice in the river had broken up in ecstasy. I thought to myself, when those tigers get upon their hind legs, they will make up their own dances. They wouldn't be content with the ones she'd teach them. And the girls will have to invent new, unprecedented tunes for them to dance to. There will be an altogether new kind of music to which they will dance of their own free will. The cats were not our only visitors. A little way off, towards the margins of the forest, I made out a group of living creatures who at first seemed almost indistinguishable from the undergrowth, for they were dressed in skins and furs of the same tawny brownish colour. But one of them was hung with little talismans of carved tin that glittered with an artificial brilliance now that the sun came out and struck him. First one, then another of them moved cautiously forward. Although their Mongolian features were characteristically inscrutable, it seemed to me most of them wore a puzzled look. They were the native woodsmen. I could tell at a glance. I did not see the big one riding the reindeer until the beast, until the attraction of the music, shifted out of the screening branches of the pines. A big one, a huge one, twice the size of the others, and oh, didn't he shine? He was so hung with baubles he looked all lit up like Piccadilly, and though he was too far away for his face to be clearly visible, I could see that face was white as milk. The sunlight struck silver off his hair and off his jaw, which at first seemed silver-plated, but it was a beard. The beard, at first, deceived me, and his long shaggy skirts with the red ribbons on them, and the big drum he held in his hand like a shield so he looked wild. What a sea change, or rather, forest change, for we were as far from the sea as you can get on this planet Earth. I thought he was become a wild, wild woman. And then I saw his jaws glint, as if silver-plated, but all it was a beard. He has been gone from me long enough to grow a beard. Oh, my heart. My heart went pitter-pat, I can tell you, as I watched him listen as if he too, like the savage beasts, though unlike his savage adopted brethren, were entranced. although he knew the singer and the song so well. My heart went pitter-pat and turned right over. "Jack! Jack!" I cried, interrupting the last verse, I'm sorry to say, such was my impetuous haste, and breaking, alas, the entire spell. "Jack Walter!" The tigers raised their heads and roared in a troubled, irritated way, as if wondering how they'd got themselves into such a state in the first place. The people who'd come out of the wood all shook themselves too, took a good look at the tigers as if they hadn't noticed them before and didn't much like what they saw now. Were they going to run away? Would he run away without seeing me? I spread. In the emotion of the moment, I spread. I spread hard enough, fast enough to bust the stitching of my bearskin jacket. I spread, bust my jacket, and outshot my you-know-whats. The escapee's mouth dropped open, which is a risky thing to do in this climate. Your lungs can freeze. The old man fell on his knees and crossed himself curiously. The woodsmen all looked in my direction. From the woodsmen, a great shout went up. In the gap left by the broken music came a drumming. The other fellow with tin spangles on started to batter away on his drum for dear life. My enthusiasm carried me a few yards through the air. Truly, I forgot my wing was broken. With the aid of the other, I fluttered lopsidedly a few yards more until I could no longer sustain myself aloft upon it and crash-landed on my face in the snowdrift as the woodsmen kicked up their mounts and fled, the drummer still drumming away, and the tigers as startled as anybody else, all streaked off too. And we were alone again. Chapter 8 The one-eyed man will be king in the country of the blind, only if he arrives there in full possession of his partial faculties. That is, providing he is perfectly aware of the precise nature of sight, and does not confuse it with second sight, nor with the mind's eye's visions, nor with madness. As Walter slowly began to recover his wits among the forest dwellers, those wits proved of as little use to him as one crazy eye would have been in a company of the sightless. When he was visited by memories of the world outside the village, as sometimes happened, he thought that he was raving. All his previous experiences were rendered null and void. If those experiences had never heretofore modified his personality to any degree, now they lost all potential they might have had for re-establishing Walter's existential credibility. Except, that is, his credibility as a dement. Happily for Walter, his host thought none the worse of him for ranting away in strange tongues. Far from it. They did not treat him like a king, but they did behave quite kindly to him, to exactly the extent that they believed him to be hallucinated, since traditionally the natives of those remote parts of Siberia regarded hallucination as a job of work. Not, of course, that theirs was in any sense the country of the blind. As far as seeing went, they made good use of their eyes. Tracks of bird and beast upon the snow were legends they descried like writing. They read the sky to know from which direction wind, snow, and the thaw would come. Stars were their compasses. The wilderness that seemed a bundle of blank paper to the ignorant urban eye was the encyclopedia, packed with information they consulted every day for every need, conning the landscape as if it were an instruction manual of universal knowledge of the inquire within type. They were illiterate, only in the literal sense, and as far as the theory and accumulation of knowledge were concerned, they were pedants. The shaman was the pedant of pedants. There was nothing vague about his system of belief. His type of mystification necessitated hard of illusory fact, and his mind was stocked with concrete specifics. With what passionate academicism he devoted himself to assigning phenomena their rightful places in his subtle and intricate theology. If he was always in demand for exorcisms and prophecies, and often asked to use his necromantic powers to hunt out minor domestic items which had been mislaid, these were frivolous distractions from the main, pressing, urgent, arduous task in hand, which was the interpretation of the visible world about him via the information he acquired through dreaming. When he slept, which he did much of the time, he would, could he have written it, have put a sign on his door, "Man at work." And even when his eyes were open, you might have said the shaman
lived in a dream, but so did they all. They shared a common dream, which was their world, and it should rather be called an idea than a dream, since it constituted their entire sense of lived reality, which impinged on real reality only inadvertently. This world, dream, dreamed idea or settled conviction extended upwards to the heavens and downwards into the bowels of the earth and the depths of the lakes and rivers, with all whose tenants they lived on intimate terms. But it did not extend laterally. It did not, could not, take into account any other interpretation of the world or dream which was not their own one. Their dream was foolproof, an engine-turned fabrication, a closed system. Foolproof because it was a closed system. The shaman's cosmogony, for all its complexity of forms, impulses and states of being perpetually in flux, was finite, just because it was a human invention and possessed none of the implausibility of authentic history. And history was a concept with which they were perfectly unfamiliar, as indeed they were with any kind of geography, except the mystically four-dimensional one they invented for themselves. They knew the space they saw. They believed in a space they apprehended. Between knowledge and belief, there was no room for surmise or doubt. They were, at the same time, pragmatic as all hell, and intellectually speaking, permanently three sheets in the wind. Until they met the Russian fur trader, who half a century previously had introduced into the tribe the strain of gonorrhea, which accounted for their historically low birth rate at this time, they had never encountered a foreigner. That is, one whose terms of reference were not their own terms. Since they did not have a word for foreigner, they used the word for devil, to designate the fur trader, and later on decided it had been such an apt choice, they continued to use the word devil as the generic term for those round-eyed ones who soon began to pop up everywhere. Because, before you could blink, an entire alien township was clustering round that first wooden hut. And now that the railway passed so close to them on its way to R, that their little children trotted alongside the great lumbering, puffing engines, cheering them on, how much longer would this community of dreamers be able to maintain the primitive integrity of its collective unconsciousness against the brutal technological actuality of the Age of Steam? For just so long, perhaps, as they conspired to ignore it. As long as none of those applauding children decided it wanted to be an engine driver when it grew up. Until such a time as one of them wondered where the trains really came from and where they were really going, instead of looking at them with indifferent wonder. And it was indifference, a cultivated indifference with which the tribespeople defended themselves against all the significance of the township of R and its residents. This indifference masked fear. They did not fear the strangers themselves. He who introduced sterility amongst them also introduced firearms, and aborigines and settlers quickly learned an armed neutrality was best. Nor did they fear the gonococci. It was another kind of infection that they feared. A spiritual infection of discontent, contracted from exposure to the unfamiliar, whose symptoms were questions. Therefore they visited the settlement of R in order to trade and to scavenge, no more. For them, R was just as much a town of dream as their own village, and they intended to keep it that way. Although Walser was twice their average size, white as stripped birchwood, and his round eyes were minus the Mongolian fold, they knew he was not a devil in the sense of a foreign devil, more a devil in the sense of demonic visitant, or wood demon, or representative of the spirit world, because of the extraordinary rapture with which he was seized during most of his waking hours. The shaman introduced his foundling to the rest of the tribe. "Behold, this dreamer!" They listened respectfully to Walser's babblings, and when they did not understand him, took it as proof he was in a holy trance. So, as Walser recovered from the amnesia that followed the blow on his head, he found himself condemned to a permanent state of sanctified delirium, or would have found himself condemned if he had been presented with any other identity but that of the crazed. As it was, his self remained in a state of limbo. Walser lived with the shaman. Even the father of the grandfather of the shaman had been a shaman. When a sickly boy, he suffered from fainting fits, just as they had done before him, During one of these fainting fits, all his marvellous forefathers visited the boy. Some wore horns, others bore udders. They stood him up like a block of wood and fired arrows at him from their bows until he went off into another fainting fit within the fainting fit. Put it another way, during his faint, he dreamed he fainted. Then his ancestors cut him up in pieces and ate him raw. They counted the bones that were left. There was one more than the regular number. That was how the ancestors knew the lad was made up of the right stuff to follow the family profession. This ritual lasted an entire summer, and while the ancestors were busy with it, the little boy was not allowed to eat or drink anything, and so grew very pale. Now he was grown up. The shaman looked at Walser's pale skin and thought that the counting of his bones must have taken much longer than a summer. Had there been some problem? Too many bones? Too few? And what might too many or too few bones mean in the great scheme of things? Just the sort of puzzle the shaman enjoyed. After the ancestors counted the bones, they put them back together again and restored the boy with a strengthening drink of reindeer blood. As he lay in his hut, his tongue began to sing of its own accord. His mother and father, both of whom were shamans, came to listen. The singing tongue told them what kind of drum their son should carry when he went to summon up the spirits. They went out to kill a reindeer and set to work at once to flay and cure the skin. The shaman gave Walser another tumblerful of piss, and Walser started to sing. The shaman listened very carefully. Walser sang,
"So we'll go no more a-roving, so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving, and the moon shine still as bright."
Such tender concern as the shaman felt, to see the tears splash down his young charge's cheeks. But the sound of his singing seemed passing strange to the shaman, unaccustomed as he was to European music. However, he was sure he interpreted the sounds correctly, so he killed a reindeer and stretched the skin out between two poles to dry. Due to the inclemency of the weather, he was forced to do this inside the hut, which soon smelled ripe. He stoked up the fire with dried branches of thyme and juniper, not so that the fragrant smoke would disguise the stink of rotting reindeer hide. Himself he rather savoured that, though Walser gagged a bit, but because the incense of the burning herbs procured visions. Walser's eyes rolled round and round in their sockets again. Splendid. Normally, Walser shared the shaman's suppers, but today, as an experiment, the shaman decided to feed Walser the same diet he offered to the idols in the austere and windowless village god hut, the quasi-anthropomorphous in front of whom he practiced the mysteries of his religion. They thrived on a porridge made of crushed barley mixed with pine nuts and broth from boiled kappa kalesi. Walser sucked up suspiciously, then pushed the porridge round and round the wooden bowl with his horned spoon. The dried herbs crackled above the stove. Walser's eyes fused.
"Hamburgers," he ruminated aloud.
The shaman pricked up his ears. Walser rambled off down a gastronomic memory lane. Who can tell what litany the shaman thought he was reciting?
"Fish soup."
Walser's face was the mirror of his memory. He grimaced. He tried again.
"Christmas dinner."
His face convulsed, and he whimpered. The words, "Christmas dinner," reminded him of something most fearful, of some hideous danger. They reminded him of the main course. They reminded him of
"Cock-a-doodle-doo!"
he cried aloud, assailed by dreadful if incomprehensible memories, then fell into a haunted silence until another happier thought came to him.
"Eel pie and mash."
At that, he beamed and rubbed his stomach with his hand. Raptly attentive, the shaman, the reader of signs, poured him more broth and waited for further revelations.
"Eel pie and mash me, old cock," said Walser, appreciatively.
The shaman decided Walser must mean the time had come to make him his shamanizing drum. Next morning, he blindfolded Walser with a strip of reindeer hide, wrapped him up warmly, took him outdoors, spun him round three times on the spot to disorient him, and gave him a hearty push. Walser lurched off. the shaman following after with an axe on his shoulder, listening intently to the soft voices of larch and birch and fir, murmuring sweet nothings to him. Walser wandered uncertainly forward. Teased by increasingly unpleasant voyages, his imagination took Eilis behind the blindfold, until he could have sworn he heard in the swish of the wind in the undergrowth the hiss of a single word, homicide. At that, Walser snatched off his blindfold and punched the shaman on the nose. But the shaman was confidently anticipating irrational behavior and punched Walser right back, although he had to jump up in the air to do so, since Walser was much taller than he. However, after that, he let Walser tramp on without the blindfold. After a while, the shaman heard a soft, persistent knocking. Walser, who could hear nothing, and indeed there was really nothing to be heard, watched the shaman suspiciously from the corner of his eye as he went up to a tree whose name Walser did not know and put his ear to the trunk. After a moment, the shaman shook his head irritably and motioned Walser to walk on. That is what the drumming tree said to the shaman.
We are fooled you.
Soon another tree began to drum, but it turned out this one too was enjoying a joke at the shaman's expense. He began to mutter under his breath. But the third drumming tree announced disconsolately, I am the one. The shaman immediately cut it down and made Walser carry the trunk home. He cut the hoop of the drum out of the wood from the tree as he sat in front of the oven in his odorous house. The shaman's quarters were a neat, snug, square one-story house built of pine logs. Over the samovar hung a leather bag decorated with eagle feathers, tails of squirrels and rabbits, tin discs, and little plaits of leather. This bag contained his amulet, which he let nobody see, not even Walser, even though he soon came to love Walser dearly. In his amulet resided the whole source of his extraordinary powers. His father, from whom he had inherited it, assured him he must never, ever reveal the contents. He was so secretive about the contents of his amulet bag, it might well have contained nothing at all. The shaman and Walser did not live alone. There was a bear, a black one, not yet a year old, still almost a cub. This bear was part pet, part familiar. He was both a real, furry and beloved bear, and at the same time, a transcendental kind of meta-bear, a minor deity, and also a partial ancestor, because the forest dwellers extended considerable procreational generosity towards the other species of the woods, and there were bears aplenty on the male side of the tribal line. The shaman believed the bear, as a baby, had been let down from the sky in a silver cradle. He saw the cradle drop down into a thicket from a silver cord, but cradle and cord had both vanished by the time he reached the baby bear. He brought it home in his fetish satchel and gave it a rag dipped in reindeer milk to suck. When the cub progressed to solids, he ate what the shaman ate, freshwater fish, porridge, game. He would be offered bear steaks only after he was dead. The shaman pierced the cub's ear and gave it copper ear bobs to make it pretty, and also gave it a copper collar and put a copper bracelet on the left paw. On its first birthday, it would be taken to the god hut, and its throat would be slit in front of an ursine idol sitting above a heaping mound of skulls of bears who had met their fate in a similar fashion. The shaman himself did not do the deed. The bear's executioner was elected from amongst the villagers by the spirits, who manifested their choice in dreams or by other extraterrestrial means, and the shaman was glad of that, because he always established such close relationships with the bears that it would have broken his heart to dispatch them, even though he knew it was all for the best. The entire village crowded into the god hut to watch the ceremony, lamenting vigorously and apologizing profusely.
Poor Bruin, we're so sorry, Bruin. How we love you, poor little Bruin. How bad we feel because we must do away with you.
Then the bear's head would be cut off, and the rest of it roasted over an open fire. The severed head, still with the copper bobs in its ears, was set in the middle of a common table, and the choicest titbits, the liver, the sweetbreads, the tender meat of loin and buttock, were laid in front of the bleeding relic, whilst everyone else feasted on the remainder of the bear's anatomy. The celebrants of this Siberian sacrament pretended not to notice